Chapter 7. The Information Superclass. The Power of Ideas. Men will never be free until the last king is strangled with the entrails of the last priest. Denis Diderot. It is no accident that terrorists who have been around since the dawn of history have risen to such prominence during the information age. Information flows provide the ultimate force multipliers for those who are otherwise, in terms of raw strength, relatively weak. In fact, the principal weapons of the terrorist are the television camera, the website, and the newspaper headline. An explosion or a gunshot is the germ, but the media is the carrier that turns an isolated tragedy, one that would have made relatively little impact in the days of slow-traveling news, into an epidemic of fear and reaction. Men with roadside bombs or explosive vests threaten only those they directly attack. Terrorists who can exploit information flows threaten societies. What was more devastating on September 11, 2001, the destruction of two buildings in Lower Manhattan, or the repeated images beamed around the world of those two iconic edifices crumbling? Al-Qaeda purposely targeted symbolic buildings. If the main objective of terrorism is to create maximum fear, then selecting images that live in the imagination, that are central to our sense of order, and then destroying them in a spectacular way is an optimal approach. Manipulating imagery has become a key skill of terrorists and insurgents in the information age. If Hamas encourages young Arabs to hurl stones at heavily armed Israeli soldiers in front of the cameras, the images are persuasive either way. The Israelis are being taunted and appear helpless and weak, or they respond as they are trained and appear excessively violent. If Osama bin Laden or Ayman al-Zawahiri appears on a videotape, he not only underscores the international community's inability to capture him, but he always automatically gets global media attention. Such appearances can serve to set the terms of debate, call supporters to action, and provoke hostile reactions. Perhaps even more than actual attacks, these cameos have become Al-Qaeda's primary means of advancing their aims outside of the Middle East. In this respect, the shadow elites that have risen to superclass status because of their global influence are not just bomb makers or gun runners. They are master semioticians, individuals who manipulate the media as adroitly as any politician or celebrity, despite their lack of PR consultants. But the information tools at the hands of shadow elites go beyond managing news imagery or making media appearances to call attention to themselves. They use the internet to expand and maintain networks with one another, to build a virtual global alliance of those who share their views, in much the same way teenage girls share gossip and fashion ideas on MySpace. Rita Katz and Josh Devon of the Site Institute, which tracks terrorist entities on the web, have written that the internet has helped fragmented networks merge to form a global jihadist community that transcends national, age, gender, and physical boundaries. The internet has given birth to a new generation of jihadists who never travel to Afghanistan or Pakistan or Yemen or Sudan or Somalia to attend an Al-Qaeda boot camp. They describe one notorious instance when a British citizen named Yunus Souli, screen name Irabi 007, independently assisted multiple terror groups, including Abu Musab al-Zarqawi's Jamaat al-Tawhid wa'al jihad, by posting and circulating propaganda, including manuals on cyber attacks. He also was found in possession of information about potential targets sent to him by terrorism-associated individuals in the United States. In their work at the Site Institute, Katz and Devon have identified and tracked jihadist message boards and identified critical links in the worldwide terrorist web presence. One example of these is the Al-Fahir Media Center, which coordinates the distribution of the most messages from jihadist leaders, official communiques, movies, and other propaganda through the most important forums. The group simultaneously serves Al-Qaeda and numerous other jihadist groups in the Middle East. Its online releases have included an insurgent video of a downed Black Hawk in Iraq, the latest speeches by Osama bin Laden and his lieutenant Ayman al-Zawahiri, and videos of an attack on Brown and Root Condor, a subsidiary of American private contractor KBR, in Algeria. In this way, are the directors of a group like the Al-Fahir Media Center as powerful as active terrorists? More powerful? Aren't they the ones who provide the structure for global networks and the real ammunition for movements that are more political than military or criminal? Don't they influence more people across borders than even senior leaders on the ground in Iraq, for example? I believe they do. The nature of power is changing. While for the most part power is highly concentrated, especially in mainstream media and information technology businesses, the information age has built-in democratizing components. Distribution used to be the barrier to entry in the media world, whether in movies, on television, on radio, or in newspapers. Building a distribution network from theater chains to delivery vans required a significant capital investment. Today, though, the means of distribution are available to all at no charge, making it possible for small, resource-poor groups to reach out and affect millions around the world. Thus, a grainy video called Evolution of Dance, featuring a guy doing the history of dance in 6 minutes, a bit of comedy fluff, was seen on YouTube by nearly 35 million people in 6 months. A trivial example, but one with significant implications. Fresh and yet strangely familiar. Bloggers and other web citizens have started to rival major media outlets in their impact, breaking stories and fueling movements. According to Alexa.com, a web information company that ranks sites by user frequency, some of the more popular blogs worldwide are WebRing, the individualist's ring, which states its purpose as supporting a strong sense of individualism and opposing firmly any form of collectivization. LouRockwell.com, an anti-state, pro-market site run by the president of the Ludwig von Mises Institute, and the Marxists' Internet Archive. These sites channel the political passions of many millions of people around the world. Much like DailyCos.com, TalkingPointsMemo.com, and a handful of others that led the mobilization of liberal Democrats in the United States in recent years, they have the potential for real political impact. Nonetheless, for all the web offers to empower the weak or to support those who cater to niche needs, look at the top-rated websites on the Alexa list as of mid-2007. They are all in the hands of undisputed members of the superclass. Some may be part of a new establishment, younger and more recently rich, but their business practices and their bank accounts and their roles in society sure look like those of elites gone by. Number one on the Alexa site, for example, is Yahoo, a publicly traded member of the S&P 500 that has annual sales in excess of $6 billion, and that until recently was run by a CEO who used to head Hollywood's long-established Warner Brothers studio. Number two is Microsoft's MSN, run by the company controlled by one of the world's richest men, Bill Gates. Number three is Google, which has more than 10,000 employees, a market capitalization of $160 billion, and annual revenues of $12 billion. YouTube at number four is owned by Google, bought for $1.65 billion, and Live.com at number five is owned by Microsoft. Number six, MySpace, is owned by Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation, one of the world's most powerful media companies. It should be noted that Gates, Murdoch, and Google founders Sergey Brin and Larry Page are all not only among the world's richest people, they also regularly appear among the top 10 of the New Establishment, as defined by Lifestyles magazine Vanity Fair. In other words, would you like a little superclass with your so-called democratizing internet revolution? That does not, of course, mean that the Internet is not a revolutionary force. It is almost certainly the most revolutionary development in human culture in many decades, driving globalization, changing social interaction, altering the nature of power, enabling the creation of wealth, transforming marketplaces. It is precisely one of those disruptive historical developments that we have seen stir up elites of the past and create new members. How it does this differs from story to story across the many varied enterprises made possible by the web, from a traditional selling platform like Amazon.com to something palpably new like a social networking site. Ellie Page has been the research director for this book, and in 2004, while still a student at Harvard, she witnessed one such revolution as her classmate, Mark Zuckerberg, presided over the inception of the website Facebook. At the time, the phrase social networking had barely even entered the lexicon, she recalled, so it wasn't immediately obvious what the site was for. Any Harvard undergrad could post a profile, a page with their name, dorm, extracurricular activities, interests, and so on, and then they could do what every nerd who suffered socially in high school dreams of. They could link up with friends to show everyone how popular they were. The site was an instantaneous hit. Word of it spread by cell phone, IM, email, and even by mouth, and in a matter of days, everyone knew about it. In a matter of a week or two, almost every undergraduate was a member. It was hard to identify the appeal at first, but it was clearly addictive. For one thing, there was something thrilling about creating your own identity and sending it out into the world, something satisfying about being able to present yourself in whatever way you wanted. In that way, it provided a venue to advertise yourself, but more importantly, it provided information on other people, even people you didn't know. You could find the classmate who happened to like the same obscure music as you, or who came from your hometown. You could keep track of who was friends with whom and who was dating whom. It opened up a whole new world of internet stalking. Maybe most important of all, it gave you something to do when you didn't want to work. In any case, almost overnight, Facebook became a major part of daily social life at Harvard. Without really realizing it, students started spending hours on the site instead of, say, actually interacting with one another. And that was only the beginning, the first flicker of a phenomenon that has made Facebook one of the most highly trafficked and highly valued sites on the web. As of 2007, Facebook had more than 50 million members around the world, with an additional 200,000 signing up every day. Alexa's list of most visited websites placed Facebook at number 15 in the world, and the purchase of a 1.6% stake in the enterprise by Microsoft put the value of the company at $15 billion and made Zuckerberg, who dropped out of Harvard to preside over the skyrocketing growth of his brainchild, $5 billion. Not bad for a 23-year-old. Does this explosion make Zuckerberg a member of the superclass? Well, yes, it does, given our definition. In fact, there is no realm in which we have been able to watch the creation of new superclass members as closely as we have in the internet world. We watched the rise of geeks and thought that this was something different, but was it really? How do these new technology elites compare to their superclass brethren? Educational background provides little distinction. Among the information revolution pioneers who attended Stanford as graduate or undergraduate students are the founders of Yahoo, the CEO of Microsoft, the creators of Google, the founder of Intel, the founder of Netflix, the founders of Hewlett-Packard, the co-founder of YouTube, the co-founder of Sun Microsystems, the founders of Cisco, and the founder of WebEx. Among those who attended Harvard, the founder of Microsoft, the founder of Facebook, the co-founder and chairman of Sun Microsystems, and the chairman and CEO of Viacom. From MIT, the co-founder of Texas Instruments, the co-founder of Qualcomm, the founder of Lotus, the founder of InfoSeek, the founder of 3Com, the co-founder of Intel. This is, of course, only a partial list. Naturally, many internet pioneers went to other schools, but the point is that this elite did not spring up a long way from the origins of other elites. The apple, as it were, did not fall far from the elite tree. Furthermore, in many cases, once their ideas took root, alumni connections brought them into direct contact with funding sources from the same schools, who became parts of networks that were vital in nurturing the new industry. Subsequently, when the companies grew and went public or were sold, this newly enriched elite connected to the elites of Wall Street and became central players at places like Davos or the Allen & Company meeting in Sun Valley or the Technology, Entertainment & Design, TED, conference. And many have then sought to use the money they made for political influence, on behalf of both their business interests and candidates who share their views. This pattern has been followed in country after country. Though the occasional new idea generates a newly minted sensation who breaks the mold, the elite of the information era have largely followed the paths and patterns of other elites. They have even exhibited the kind of overreaching and produced the kind of backlash seen in the robber baron days, the antitrust cases against Microsoft, Oracle, and others. The investigations into the backdating of options at Apple Computer, the congressional hearings into censorship deals between the Chinese government and Yahoo, Google, and Microsoft, record companies filing suit against file-sharing websites like Napster and Kazaa, television networks going after YouTube. And these clashes have not happened only in the United States. There has been major opposition to internet sites in China, trials and convictions of internet moguls in Asia and in Europe, and the targeting of many once sound investment deals and practices that, following a market downturn, were revealed to be something else, and sometimes nothing more than pure scams. Among the most dramatic of these stories is the rise and fall of Takafumi Hori, who, in his mid-30s, has followed the most stunning trajectory of any internet billionaire. Hori built a social networking site called LiveDoor into a giant among Japanese web enterprises, following the model of U.S. startups and even mimicking the elite university dropout model of Gates, Zuckerberg, and others when he left Japan's number one school, Tokyo University, in order to pursue his vision. Hori's aggressive business tactics in his management of LiveDoor rocked the staid Japanese establishment, a group already uncomfortable with his rock star style and his repeated shows of disrespect for the status quo. Only 2 years into the enterprise, he was accused of stock manipulation through accounting misstatements, totaling perhaps $40 million. He was tried in 2007 and sentenced to 30 months in prison. Once over $1 billion, his net worth has fallen to a paltry $100 million or so. Yet Hori remains undaunted. He argues that the establishment turned against him in part because he tried to buy a baseball team and part of a much larger, more established company called Fuji Sankey Communications Group. "The people who found me the most offensive are mid-managers with a stake in the old system, those in their 40s and 50s, he told the New York Times in early 2007. "Those people have invested decades in their companies. They don't want the world they believed in and guarded until now to break apart, not after they've toiled for 20-30 years without enjoying its benefits. They're going to let this punk smash it all?" Many note that not only was Hori's sentence unusually harsh, but that there is some hypocrisy in a system that punished him for his comparatively minor misdeeds when much more deep-seated and dubious accounting practices have dogged Japan's biggest companies for years. This, and the way the media has piled on to his case, have left many wondering whether there is some truth to his assertions that he simply upset Japan's rigid establishment more than it could bear. Hori certainly speaks to the more pernicious influence of the superclass, driven less by nefarious plan than by unbridled and unthinking self-interest. I once observed senior executives of a big technology company as they bald-facedly asserted that they wanted Chinese market share and would be willing to trade their internet know-how, in particular their ability to help the Chinese censor web usage, for that market share if they could. This was a big company, and they well understood the ramifications of their decision. There was no gray area. They were deliberately crossing a bright line. New technology firms have made other compromises to achieve continued growth, encountering culture shocks as they are forced to respond more to the requirements of shareholders than to their own muses. A common story of the information age is the saga of the entrepreneur who must ultimately step down so that professional managers can take his or her company to the next stage. Since the company's capital is often largely concentrated within the hands of financial institutions that I have discussed earlier, investment banks, private equity companies, and venture capital funds, one can see how the tech revolution quietly fell into the hands of the existing power elite. One prominent internet pioneer with whom I spoke became rueful and somewhat guarded as we approached the subject of tension between old and new elites. He had faced the challenge of blending the culture of his company into that of a more established organization, one of those still popular deals that enabled those who were part of old media to be transformed by the ideas of new media and to stimulate reinvention. Instead, many of these marriages have been rocky ones, business versions of Samuel Huntington's Clash of Civilizations. It was natural, mused the CEO. We should have known that better, perhaps. And it was full of challenges, but it is also the way progress is made, right? He seemed to suggest that the old would inevitably reach out to the new, that they would try to change each other, and that, like a cold front meeting a warm front, thunderstorms might ensue. Bob Wright, on the other side of the old-new divide, has a long history in the media game. I met him in his offices at 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York, where, from 1986 until early 2007, he ran the National Broadcasting Company. In an industry that traditionally has fickle relationships with its top executives, Wright had remarkable staying power, largely due to his record of building NBC from a television network into a widely diversified media company. Under his leadership, NBC Universal encompassed the network, Universal Movie Studios, various cable holdings, international holdings such as Telemundo, and various new media outlets. Although passing on the reins of NBC, he remains a vice chairman of General Electric. Easy to talk to, well-liked, a lawyer by training, Wright, in his early 60s, is one of the senior statesmen of the global media business. When speaking about new media, though, he seemed genuinely perplexed. It is clear that he and his colleagues know that everything about their industry is changing, but they don't yet know what the business model is. It is striking. These are the best minds at the pinnacle of the industry, nearly two decades after the introduction of the World Wide Web, and there is very limited forward visibility even at the highest levels, even from a suite high atop one of New York's most famous office towers, with stunning views of the city below. Say we do, 16 large films a year and another 10 smaller films, 25 or 30 total, and we sent those to Japan today, we'll only be able to air 4 or 5 of those to the third biggest economy in the world, Wright told me. On the other hand, the internet capacity is unlimited, but also unfettered from a regulatory point of view. So, if we want to look on the glass half full, there is an opening ability to communicate to a much larger crowd than we're used to, and we just have to figure out how to be part of that communication process. When I first came in here, the issue was, is broadcast going to survive? Are newspapers going to survive? Are magazines as they were then going to survive? And the answer is yes and no. Our principal income comes from our cable television networks, not from NBC. And our film business is still pretty good because there's a lot of ways to distribute them, and television's going to be part of that around the world. The broadcasting business is still a pretty good business, but it isn't what it was, and it is harder and harder. But everybody that is in the traditional media business has to acknowledge that this is a frighteningly complex scheme that we're getting involved in. Pamela Thomas Graham, a Harvard-educated former McKinsey consultant who writes murder mysteries in her spare time, worked with Wright for years as the CEO of CNBC. Then, and during her subsequent stint as group president at the Liz Claiborne Fashion Company, she too saw the challenges posed by new media, especially as it impacted the business with which she was most familiar, the news industry. From her office in New York's Garment District, she told me, "There has been this elite, and in general that elite has been fairly discreet and fairly clubby, and some of it has been fueled by media and kind of the ownership of media news organizations. But now, with the rise of blogs and the democratization of the news industry, such as it is, those elites are being penetrated by people in Iowa who just happen to have the time and the resources to try to connect all these little dots. So it's interesting that scale is being turned on its head in some ways, particularly in the news business." News media elites have not only upended the mainstream news establishment, they have fundamentally altered the industry. The rise of the 24/7, updated by the second blogosphere, for example, has made speed and timeliness ever more critical in news reporting. This, too, poses challenges when broadcasters have to verify stories and sources in record time in order to remain competitive. As Thomas Graham recalled, "One of the things I was trying to instill at CNBC was the fact that, as a news organization, you've got to be able to make the right judgment call. There is a moment when your interests and those of your source clearly diverge, and you've got to be the journalist at that point. It is a fine line to walk." It has been a particular challenge at organizations like CNBC, which itself represented a revolution in live, narrowly focused stock market coverage, where the connections between real-time news reporting and real-time market trading have produced a new kind of symbiosis between reporters and the field they are covering. Markets rise and fall based on whether broadcasters report that they are heading up or down. The key media personalities become exceptionally powerful. Said Thomas Graham, "Some people wrote their PhD theses on the CNBC effects on market performance, and it was real. I mean, it continues to happen on certain programs. I'd say Maria Bartiromo and Jim Cramer are two that actually really do, I think, have impact because they're both extremely well plugged in and because everything's happening in real time." A former U.S. official who served in the top tier of government for over four decades recalled listening to a panel of tech experts, including Google head Eric Schmidt, eBay CEO Meg Whitman, then chief of Yahoo Terry Semel, CEO of Interactive Corp Barry Diller, and Wikipedia founder Jimmy Wales. An amazing panel, and they all were talking about these technologies, and everyone was on the edge of their seats. And I thought this was all irrelevant, that none of these guys were the actual inventors. They're the CEOs who are administering them. The next generation is being invented now by some nerd who can't get a date in his garage. The question is, the official wondered, what is the political effect of the new media networks on events? Is it good or bad? And here they split. Eric Schmidt said information dissemination is always good, and then he defended the extremely important decision Google had taken to cut a deal with the Chinese on the grounds that 97% or 98% of all the stuff on Google worldwide would still be available in China for the sake of 2 or 3%. Other people on the panel laughed at him and said that was a commercial decision, and he held his ground, but from the audience came voices saying, "You're wrong. This can be used as a force of evil. The modern Goebbels is lurking out there somewhere using it." An ascendant voice of change in the Middle East. In the rapidly changing landscape of information technology, even traditional media are being used in revolutionary ways, allowing for the emergence of unconventional media elite members like Sheikh Hamad bin Tamer Al Thani. Al Thani is a member of the Qatari ruling family and a distant cousin of the current emir, Sheikh Hamad bin Khalifa Al Thani. He began his career in the Ministry of Information and eventually reached the position of first undersecretary to the Minister of Information. Following the ministry's abolition in the mid-1990s, he was seized with the idea of starting an independent news organization in the vein of the BBC or CNN. Qatar's emir saw the station as a chance to elicit support from the West so as to dissuade a possible invasion from its larger neighbors. In 1994, the channel was established, and by 1996, Al Jazeera was being broadcast across the region. The station was planned to be self-sufficient, funded by advertising revenue. But many governments in the Middle East, particularly the Saudis, have taken a negative view of the channel due to its criticism of their policies, and have pressured companies not to advertise on Al Jazeera. Consequently, the station has continued to be supported largely by the government of Qatar. The channel has an opaque relationship with Sheikh Hamad bin Khalifa Al Thani, but as Hugh Miles put it in Foreign Policy, the emir has thus far kept his fingers off the station, and Al Jazeera has thrived under his aegis. The station purports to offer a Middle Eastern view of world affairs and was originally held up by the West as a beacon of independent reporting, especially its coverage of controversial issues such as women's rights. But recently, Al Jazeera has been attacked by the American administration for giving too much airtime to terrorists, including Osama bin Laden and the Iraqi insurgency. Media coverage that, as mentioned earlier, provides the ultimate force multiplier for the relatively weak. The station's antagonism of the U.S. regime even led President Bush to contemplate bombing the station's Doha headquarters in 2004. The American-led invasion of Afghanistan following the 9/11 attacks truly lifted the station into the international spotlight. Al Jazeera was the only television station that was allowed to report from inside Taliban-ruled Afghanistan, and as a result, many news agencies around the world depended on the station for images and information. Notable scoops included the American bombing campaign, the Taliban's destruction of ancient Buddhist statues, and exclusive videos of Al-Qaeda and Taliban leaders. Having made a name for itself, the station has expanded its operations to include an English-language website and new offices in London, Kuala Lumpur, and Washington. It plainly wants to compete with CNN and the BBC. It has hired many journalists from these organizations and recently began airing an English-language 24-hour news station. It has also sparked the establishment of a number of competitors in the Middle East, including the Saudi-backed Al Arabiya television station. New media monkey gland injections. A quick shot of sizzle. The established media giants of the past are often, as noted earlier, in the position of incorporating new media innovations to serve the interests of existing elites. It is the equivalent of what Richard Burns, my former business partner, used to call a monkey gland injection, an effort to revitalize the organization in a single action. Every newspaper with a hope of surviving is now a web business. Sports empires are built on fan bases that are expanded through video games. Columnists become bloggers. The biggest and most successful media executives of today are thus those who are best able to continually reinvent their companies and, to some extent, themselves. No one has done this more deftly or while generating more debate than Rupert Murdoch. As chairman and chief executive of News Corporation, Rupert Murdoch owns roughly 30% of the company and a majority holding of voting stock, which gives him virtually complete control. The voting structure results in News Corp being, according to Time magazine, one of the few mega corporations controlled by a single individual. The company itself was, in mid-2007, worth almost $70 billion, even before its successful takeover of the Wall Street Journal, by far the most influential daily business newspaper in the world. Australian by birth, Murdoch followed the path of colonial elites of the era and went off to Oxford University. Then he returned to Australia to begin building his media empire, buying up a series of local and national newspaper businesses. By the end of the 1960s, Murdoch had established himself as one of the leading newspaper barons in the world with his ownership of London's News of the World, and not long after strengthened his global market share by acquiring The Sun, The Times, and The Sunday Times of London. He continued to expand his print empire into the 1980s and broke into the American market with the purchase of the New York Post. In 1985, Murdoch became a nationalized American citizen to fulfill the requirements of the U.S. media ownership laws, recognition on his part of the preeminence of the U.S. information industry in the information age. He had gained full control over 20th Century Fox production studio and the Fox television network the previous year, which solidified his position as one of the most influential individuals in the world. Through these outlets, the driven yet often warmly charming Murdoch oversaw the creation and distribution of a solid string of hits, including the Alien movies, Titanic, The Simpsons, and the global American Idol franchise. News Corp has major stakes in satellite television services, including DirecTV in the Americas, the assorted Sky services in Europe, and the Asian Star TV. Finally, the corporation also owns HarperCollins Publishing House. In 2006, Murdoch aligned himself with Ahmet Erdogan, the founder of Atlantic Records, who held Turkish citizenship, to skirt a Turkish media ownership law in his bid to enter the Middle Eastern market. Through these holdings, Murdoch has a huge level of influence over the information and entertainment that reaches hundreds of millions of people. These achievements aside, Murdoch is probably best known for revolutionizing television news with the creation of the self-proclaimed fair and balanced Fox News Channel in 1996. The station is currently the most popular 24-hour news station in the United States, ahead of fellow billionaire Ted Turner's CNN. Journalist James Poniewozik has written, "Fox taught TV news that voice, provocation, and fun are not things to be afraid of. And, for better or worse, probably every TV news program outside of PBS has been Foxified by now. The explosive graphics on your newscast, the free speech opinion segments on the new CBS Evening News, that's Fox. You may tell yourself you don't watch Fox News, but as they used to say in the old Palmolive commercials, you're soaking in it." While other media conglomerates may be larger and more profitable, few are as powerful as Murdoch's News Corp, in part because Murdoch actively seeks to use his power to advance his political views. The analogy with military elites is clear. Having the ability to project force is one thing. Having the will to use it is another. Murdoch has the will to use his influence and regularly does. There is an understanding that Murdoch generally has the ability to affect the editorial opinions of his newspapers. For example, according to The Guardian, not a single one of News Corp's papers opposed the invasion of Iraq at the beginning of 2003. Murdoch's involvement in the output of his media outlets was, in fact, the main point of criticism by the Wall Street Journal's editorial board, which resisted Murdoch's bid for their owning company, Dow Jones, in 2007. Other reports suggest that when attempting to take over Warner Communications during the mid-80s, Murdoch directed reporters at the New York Post to dig into the background of Warner's Steve Ross to help with the legal process involved in the attempted acquisition. He also repeatedly pushed stories that would help and blocked projects that he felt would hinder his business interests or the interests of political allies. But one individual close to Murdoch for many years told me, "He is incredibly complex, and the story is not a simple one. He has saved countless businesses that would have folded in other hands. And if he were such an ideologue, would he have backed Blair or Hillary Clinton or gotten along so well with the Chinese government? When it comes to politics, Murdoch is consistently pragmatic about whom he supports in elections and does not belong to either party in the United States. Despite the conservative slant of many of his outlets, Fox News Channel and the New York Post are perhaps the two most prominent, he recently hosted a fundraiser for Democratic presidential candidate Senator Hillary Clinton, as well as a retreat attended by Bill Clinton and Al Gore. The former chairman of the FCC, Reed Hunt, noted that he has a far better understanding of how to influence government than anybody else I've ever met in the media. The former New York City mayor, Ed Koch, recalled receiving a personal phone call from Murdoch when Koch was running for the mayoralty in 1977. When Murdoch informed him that he would be endorsed by the Post the following morning, "I said, Rupert, you just elected me." And he had. The Post's endorsement transformed my campaign. I wouldn't have won without it. Murdoch's accumulation of personal power was confirmed by his close friend Irwin Stelzer of the Sunday Times. "They say Rupert talks to Tony Blair to protect his company, News Corp. Maybe there's a small element of that, but that's not what drives him. It's about affecting events." For now, Murdoch is well placed to do just that. Though he rules in an industry where change is the only constant, and he will have to change with it to maintain his position. News media in particular have evolved considerably in the last 5 years, not only with the rise of internet news and blogs as discussed, but also with reporting that is increasingly entertainment-oriented in nature. Indeed, more Americans in the 18 to 25 age bracket get their news from Jon Stewart's fake news program, The Daily Show, than from any other source. Keeping in step, Murdoch's Fox News Channel introduced the half-hour news hour in 2007 to compete with Comedy Central's popular parody. In the global era, overlapping networks of entertainment celebrities have more than star power. They have the power to affect real-world outcomes, political and otherwise. Pro bono. Some musicians and actors are known around the world. Their images plaster magazine covers, they sell millions of records, they bring in hundreds of millions in box office sales. Their every move is fodder for speculation in celebrity tabloids, on TV, and throughout the web. They are more famous and better recognized than almost anyone else on the planet. Such is the power and reach of popular culture. A select few of these celebrities have transcended their pop culture status and aspired to use their unrivaled visibility to generate greater influence. Musicians like Bono or Peter Gabriel or Bob Geldof have become regulars at elite assemblies like Davos, but they can also be found behind the scenes, working with government leaders to advance causes like bringing aid to Africa. Bono, for one, has been a whirlwind in recent years, guest editing an issue of Vanity Fair on Africa, creating programs to raise awareness through highly identifiable red products that raise money for African causes, and pressing government leaders for debt relief for developing nations. Geldof has done likewise, helping to organize massive worldwide concerts like the Live Aid events, which harnessed the power of multiple pop stars to bring attention to the plight of the world's poorest. How informed are these celebrity ambassadors? Are entertainers suited for policy work and grounded in the substance of the issues? Said one former top official of a multilateral development agency, "I've seen these guys in action, and their commitment is impressive." Naturally, they are not development professionals, but what they bring in passion and access to the media is vitally important. In one instance, I remember vividly watching Bono work the back halls at the G8 summit in Gleneagles, Scotland, and I was really struck by how up to speed he was. Geldof was there too, and though he worked hard, he was not in the same league as Bono. Bono is far more than just a well-intentioned celebrity with a craving for attention. As one European development official said to me at last year's World Economic Forum, "It's easy to snipe, but I don't think there is a single public official who has done more to raise awareness of Africa or to mobilize action than Bono. If he ended up winning the Nobel Peace Prize, it would not be such a great stretch." Other celebrities, like Angelina Jolie, Nicole Kidman, and Michael Douglas, to name a few, have actually been designated as UN ambassadors. While some have used the position for photo ops, Jolie has gotten credit for her energy and intelligence in approaching the plight of children in the developing world, far beyond her propensity for adopting a few of them. Recognizing the importance of her mission, the prestigious Council on Foreign Relations recently granted term membership to Jolie, almost certainly the only current term member without a college education. British Minister of State for Foreign Affairs for Asia, Africa, and the UN, Mark Malik Brown, was in 2006 asked by Time magazine to profile Jolie for its 100 Most Influential People in the World issue. He described his meeting with her. "There was, with my wife Trish, much chuckling on this. The story is that she wanted to meet me for a briefing before she went to Davos last year. The article actually could have been much funnier, but it read that somehow I had been standoffish, and she insisted on meeting me at this London hotel, about which, of course, I got to hear my locker room friends all roaring about with disbelief. In reality, the funniest aspect was that Trish called me from a broken-down car with a sick daughter, Maddie, on her way back from a doctor in the winter snow of Westchester, and said, 'Where are you? I suppose you are doing something great.' I said, 'Actually, I'm in a hotel room with Angelina Jolie.' But, fun aside, when we spoke, I was impressed with her knowledge and her commitment." Malik Brown also described the G8 summit at Gleneagles. "I was there last year with Kofi Annan, then the UN Secretary General. Bono is genuinely knowledgeable with his stuff. And with his smart guy advocate allies, they were really making a difference. They got Kofi to help arrange one last go at how to engineer a trade breakthrough there for the poor countries. But just imagine the hotel room with these two, Bono and Kofi. Ultimately, it is just a handful of celebrities like this who, in their spare time from their entertainment jobs, or their roles as queens or princesses or whatever, are smart enough to use what they have very well. The question is, are they representative of something broader? Are they a missing link between these detached global elites and mass opinion and mass culture? I think they are obviously filling a vacuum." The motto of my junior high school in Summit, New Jersey, and countless other schools, I would warrant, was, "Knowledge is power." But in the current era, celebrity is power. With modern information technologies, celebrity amounts to the ability to command the attention of mass audiences. Just as terrorists try to commandeer that visibility to capture the new global means of distributing information for their purposes, so can celebrities turn the fact that the cameras and the reporters seek them out into power. For David Beckham or Cristiano Ronaldo, for Michael Jordan or Tiger Woods, or any big-name star endorsing a product, this is the power to generate revenue for a client, to draw consumers to merchandise or services associated with them. For others, it can be the power to raise awareness of an issue, to fuel passions and initiate action and mobilize resources, as have Bono, Bob Geldof, Angelina Jolie, and Shakira, the Colombian pop star and UNICEF ambassador. When Shakira tells Chilean President Michelle Bachelet, "Education is not a luxury, it is a right everyone should have," it may not ring with new insight, but it has many more times the impact than 1,000 experts would have.
Saving the world one idea at a time. Not all of the world-class activists who might be found at Davos or other elite retreats are rock stars, of course. In fact, few are as easily distinguishable as Bono might be as he slips through the crowds in his tight leather pants wearing his trademark wraparound shades. It is a pity, actually, because it might save needless embarrassment. I recall vividly an evening function several years ago in Davos, during which I was standing next to a compact, friendly, bearded man whose badge was obscured, but who was holding court among the group of business and government leaders with whom we were both chatting. Warm and emphatic on the subject of the environment, he spoke English with a Mexican accent. During a lull in the conversation, I introduced myself, hoping to elicit a clarification from him as to who he might be. Another in the group, a garrulous woman who was also Latin, if I recall correctly, recognizing that I was moments away from making an irredeemable fool of myself, said, "Oh, don't you know Mario?" There was apparently not much of a flicker of recognition from my eyes, and she then said, "This is Mario Molina. He won the Nobel Prize in chemistry." I shook his hand, but it was more evident than I would have liked that I had not heard of him. "He is the one who discovered that we were destroying the ozone layer," the woman went on, and then, quietly, in the kind of slow whisper saved for children you are trying to spare embarrassment, she added, "He has helped save the world." Molina was exceptionally kind during the remainder of the conversation, but was soon swept off in another direction, heading to an evening conclave of several Nobel laureates. There he characteristically underscored that, despite the progress made since he and co-Nobelist Sherwood Rowland wrote their groundbreaking 1974 article in Nature explaining how the use of chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs, was leading to depletion of the protective ozone in the atmosphere, much more needed to be done to avert the potentially catastrophic consequences of climate change. Several years later, at another such event I happened to attend, I heard former U.S. Vice President Al Gore refer to Molina as not only a genuine hero of the effort to preserve the environment, but a man with a special ability to bring people together. Gore said that Molina, the only Mexican-born scientist to win the Nobel, was the sole person he knew, for example, who got along with both the mayor of Mexico City and the president of Mexico, bitter rivals who had recently competed in a hotly contested election to occupy Los Pinos, that country's presidential palace. Mexico's president Felipe Calderón underscored the power of the image that has evolved around Molina as a result of his actions. When trying to describe the image he sought for Mexico going forward, he said at Davos in 2007, "We want to revert the image of the guy leaning up against a tree, snoozing with his sombrero pulled down over his eyes, to the Mexico of Nobel Prize scientist Mario Molina and Golden Globe winning director Alejandro González Iñárritu." Molina has said that growing up in Mexico City, he found that science was not highly valued as a pursuit for a young boy, and that he had to work to offset the image problems that this lack caused him. But just 2 years after completing his studies as an undergraduate in Mexico, and then as a graduate student in Germany and the United States, he permanently altered not only the way the world would perceive him, but how it would perceive itself when, working as a postdoctoral fellow for Rowland at the University of California at Irvine, he became the principal author of their article demonstrating that emerging concerns about the impact of chlorofluorocarbons from refrigerators and aerosol cans were warranted, and predicting the formation of what has become known as the ozone hole. At the time of the article's release, many, even in the scientific community, were skeptical. But as noted in Molina's Nobel citation, many were critical of their calculations, but yet more were seriously concerned by the possibility of a depleted ozone layer. Today we know that they were right in all essentials. It was to turn out they had even underestimated the risk. The Nobel Committee went further in describing the work, noting reverently that through the international agreements that ultimately resulted from their research and which banned the chemicals that were doing the damage, the work of Molina, Rowland, and their co-recipient, Professor Paul Crutzen of the Max Planck Institute for Chemistry, contributed to our salvation from a global environmental problem that could have catastrophic consequences. Recent scientific data has demonstrated that the Montreal Protocol, the treaty that led to the reduction of ozone-depleting chemicals, has actually worked. Compelling evidence has been cited that suggests ozone is being lost less quickly, and that within several decades, actual recovery of the damaged atmospheric layer might begin. What is only implied by the data, however, are the political and economic dynamics involved in turning scientific conclusions into global action. It is in those dynamics that the likes of Molina and his colleagues transcend the distinction of being elite scientists and meet our criteria for inclusion among the members of the superclass, which is to say not only impacting the lives of millions across borders, but doing it on a regular basis. It requires something more than just being innovative or rigorous or capable of elegant scientific reasoning. It also requires the ability to translate discoveries and conclusions into action. Molina meets this requirement and, indeed, is a superb example of what might be called the scientist activist, a number of whom certainly qualify to be members of the superclass, ranging from the likes of Anthony Fauci of the U.S. National Institutes of Health, who was at the vanguard of scientists working to both combat and raise awareness of AIDS, to J. Craig Venter, an evangelist for the benefits of mapping the human genome, to those on the darker side of the use of their scientific skills, such as Pakistan's A.Q. Khan. The scientific community is built more than many other groups around the idea of global networks, cooperation, and communication, which makes having global influence that much more natural. But as in Molina's case, merely discovering and then sharing an idea is not enough. In the mid-1980s, as the debate leading up to the Montreal Protocols was heating up, major business groups such as the Alliance for Responsible CFC Policy, comprised of more than 500 organizations in the United States, mobilized to blunt the efforts of Molina and others seeking to ban or limit the production of the products they produced. This group noted that CFC sales in the United States at the time were more than $750 million and said that the annual sales of goods and services dependent on these products was $27 billion. Powerful economic cases were being made and political opposition to change was being mobilized. However, because of the activism of Molina and his colleagues in promoting their findings, and because of their continual research into new dimensions of the brewing crisis, such as demonstrating that the ozone depletion discovered over Antarctica was a result of the impact of extreme cold in the atmosphere on the CFCs, incontrovertible evidence was produced and then publicized via active use of the media. It is a formula that has been used similarly in recent years to promote the data substantiating other dimensions of climate change, notably those associated with the man-made causes of global warming. Molina remains an activist. In August 2007, he wrote an article in the Financial Times to commemorate the 20th anniversary of the Montreal Accord, urging that the treaty be expanded to seize the opportunity to reduce climate emissions by many times the reductions mandated under the Kyoto Protocol on climate change. He went on to emphasize the impact of collaboration among the scientists and policymakers who produced the international agreement, which virtually eliminated ozone-depleting substances in the developed world and substantially reduced them elsewhere. Current estimates suggest these measures will, within 6 decades, prevent more than 6 million skin cancer deaths in the United States alone, producing over $4 trillion in health benefits. That is a disaster the size of the Holocaust prevented, thanks to the powerful combination of science, activism, modern information technologies, and responsive political systems. And it clearly underscores the special place scientists can have among the superclass. The Reenchantment of the World. Today, confounding centuries of anticipation of the arrival of an era in which science trumped the historical dominance of faith-based institutions, the power of religion is combining with the power of modern media to facilitate a religious rebirth. This in turn has re-energized and empowered an important component of the global superclass, the religious leaders of the information age. For most of the 20th century, conventional wisdom and an expansive body of literature posited that modernization would create more secular societies. In the early 1900s, the sociologist Max Weber called this phenomenon the disenchantment of the world. Capitalism would replace godly worship with devotion to the dollar, and the spread of science and literacy would undermine the turn to God to explain the unknown. In mid-century, President Kennedy was elected after proclaiming his belief in America, where the separation of church and state is absolute. When no public official either requests or accepts instructions on public policy from the Pope, the National Council of Churches, or any other ecclesiastical source. Popular support for a government free from religious influence coincided with conspicuous signs of atheism and spiritual doubt, and not only in the United States. The Harvard theologian Harvey Cox described in 1965 the loosing of the world from religious and quasi-religious understandings of itself in his controversial book, The Secular City. The following year, Time ran a cover story entitled, Is God Dead?, which observed, nearly one of every two men on earth lives in thraldom to a brand of totalitarianism that condemns religion as the opiate of the masses, which has stirred some to heroic defense of their faith, but has also driven millions from any sense of God's existence. Millions more in Africa, Asia, and South America seem destined to be born without any expectation of being summoned to the knowledge of the one God. Of course, there was something else in the supposed question, a classically American implication that everyone else must be wrong. But the question was a real one. To many, religion increasingly seemed as ancient and distant as the stories that it venerated. As a consequence, as religious elites were losing their flocks, they also seemed to be losing significance in the global power structure. But by the early 1970s, many areas of the world began witnessing a backlash to secularism, and with it, the reemergence of powerful religious leaders. The religious reversion was especially marked in the Middle East and Southeast Asia. In Iran, the secular and Western-oriented Shah saw his power diminish through the 1970s, culminating in the revolutionary ascension of Ayatollah Khomeini in 1979. Similar movements toward more religious forms of nationalism took place in India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Sri Lanka. A born-again Baptist president, Jimmy Carter, was elected in the United States, and Americans turned en masse to the televised sermons of evangelist Jerry Falwell and other broadcast ministries. Catholicism blossomed in the developing world during the reign of modern history's most popular pope, John Paul II. And by the late 1980s, his communist adversaries, not just in Poland but throughout the world, faltered and collapsed. The trend in religion's political victories continued through the 1990s, with the rise of the Taliban in Afghanistan, and into the 21st century, with the victory of Hamas in the Palestinian elections and Christian conservatives in the United States. These political movements reflected a more general transformation. In many parts of the world, people were becoming more religious. The chief rabbi of Great Britain argued, "Religion is no longer marginal to the international politics. After a long period of eclipse, it has reemerged with immense and sometimes destructive force." Economic globalization, urbanization, education, and the spread of democracy have brought about not secularization, but a spiritual reawakening in many parts of the world. A number of polls reveal this rise in religious observance and adherence. The two largest sects of Christianity, Catholicism and Protestantism, could both claim larger percentages of the world's population in 2000 than they could a century before. According to a 2005 compilation of sources, 84% of all people consider themselves religious. The trend may vary somewhat by geographic region. Europe notably remains decidedly secular, with a mere 21% of its people claiming that religion is very important to them. But overall, the picture is one of an increasingly religious world. The result is a pronounced concentration of power among religious leaders. Just a few religions are dominant, and it is their leaders who have the greatest global followings and influence. Christianity dominates the world scene by far, with 2.1 billion estimated adherents, followed by Islam at 1.5 billion, Hinduism at 900 million, traditional Chinese religions with 394 million, and Buddhism with 376 million. Fewer than a dozen religions have more than 10 million members. Of course, within the biggest religions, there are important divisions. Catholics and Protestants are no longer killing one another with the frequency that shaped the history of the Reformation, but still the differences are great. The divisions within Islam, primarily the conflict between Sunnis and Shiites, which dates back to a dispute over who should succeed Muhammad to lead his followers, are as profound and deadly today as at any time since they first triggered violence in the 7th century. In light of the resurgence in religious adherence, particularly Christianity and Islam, cultural critics have had to rethink the complex relationship between religion and modernity. In many respects, the rise of religions as vibrant mass movements has been aided, not impeded, by globalization. Information technology and the communications boom have helped religious groups and their leaders spread their message around the world, attracting new followers and securing networks among existing ones. Television, radio, movies, and especially the internet have become extremely effective tools of modern proselytizing for religious groups from Muslims to Mormons. This use of communications technology, moreover, is hardly a one-way flow of information, as traditional proselytizing is usually conceived, but rather allows for the exchange of ideas among preachers and adherents. In this way, the increased connectivity characteristic of globalization fosters religious pluralism. Modern Christianity provides one example of the possibilities for diversity and transnational scope within a single religion. "Consider what went on last Sunday," wrote the historian Mark Knoll. "More Roman Catholics attended church in the Philippines than in any single country of Europe. In China, where in 1970 there were no legally functioning churches at all, more believers probably gathered for worship than in all of so-called Christian Europe. And in Europe, the church with the largest attendance last Sunday was in Kiev, and it is a church of Nigerian Pentecostals. Last Sunday, more Anglicans attended church in each of Kenya, South Africa, Tanzania, and Uganda than did Anglicans in Britain and Canada and Episcopalians in the U.S. combined. And several times more Anglicans attended church in Nigeria than in these other African countries. In Korea, where a century ago there existed only a bare handful of Christian believers, more people attended the Yoedo Full Gospel Church in Seoul than all of the churches in significant American denominations like the Christian Reformed Church. In the United States, Roman Catholic Mass was said in more languages than ever in American history. Last Sunday, many of the churches with the largest congregations in England and France were filled with African or Caribbean faces. As a final indication of global trends, as of 1999, the largest chapter of the Jesuits was in India, and not in the United States, as had been the case for many decades before. Modern Christianity has witnessed another phenomenon in the proliferation of massive churches. The largest in the world, Yoedo Full Gospel Church in South Korea, serves over 800,000 worshippers. Every Sunday, the church in downtown Seoul holds two services, each attended by more than 12,000 people. According to the Mega Church Research Center in Bolivar, Missouri, there were 10 non-Catholic megachurches in the United States in 1970. In 2005, there were 282. Rick Warren, author of The Purpose-Driven Life and pastor of the 15,000-strong Saddleback Church in Orange County, California, is often identified as the inventor of the modern megachurch. Tired of hellfire sermons and empty rituals, Warren opened Saddleback in 1980, intending to draw in the everyman parishioner. He has since spread his vision of purpose-driven faith on a global scale. He took a tour of 13 countries in 2006, including a stopover in Seoul, where he spoke to a crowd of 100,000. Warren has identified the megachurch as a potential means of global problem solving. "Nothing comes close to the size of churches," he says. "They have the broadest distribution network, the most volunteers, local credibility. All these different things that make the church poised to deal with these issues of spiritual emptiness and corrupt leadership and poverty and disease and illiteracy, which are problems that affect billions of people, not just millions." Already in the United States, megachurches function not only as places of worship and community gathering, but also, according to the New York Times, they often operate almost like surrogate governments, providing a variety of social services, including counseling and schooling. Indeed, these churches have the potential to rival national governments and secular civil society organizations in their capacity to address global challenges. Churches becoming involved in global affairs is nothing new, especially in the Christian tradition of proselytizing that drove much of the Age of Exploration, and today inspires liberation theologians in Central America and religious freedom advocates in China. Their power is manifest similarly in the ability of the leaders of Islam to issue fatwas, commands to the faithful that know no borders, such as the one condemning writer Salman Rushdie after publication of the Satanic Verses, which was considered to be deeply sacrilegious. Or likewise the calls for protests and revenge that extended across the Middle East and into Europe in response to Danish cartoons that appeared to lampoon the Prophet Muhammad. New information technologies enable religious leaders to call for action or to pronounce decisions with the weight of law in ways that have instantaneous global impact. Pastor of Partying. A cadre of religious leaders worldwide stand out for their ability to harness modern information technologies in order to expand their influence, generate revenues, and gain international stature. It is worth examining a handful of cases to look for patterns, to compare them to other global elites, and to attempt to discern how their roles or the roles of those like them may evolve in the future. Luis Palau has made a number of names for himself. He is the international evangelist, or the Billy Graham of Latin America, or most recently, pastor of Party Hardy Evangelism. Beginning in 1999, Palau's Christian Evangelical Enterprise, already famous for drawing crowds in the hundreds of thousands around the world, changed formats in order to reach even larger audiences. The Luis Palau Association began hosting massive festivals in open venues where families and friends could mingle, almost unconsciously absorbing the message of Jesus Christ subtly inserted among gospel concerts and celebrity guests. One newspaper described it as stealth evangelism. His festivals offer no displays of religious symbols, no robed choirs, no clergy on stage, no solemn Bible readings or long-winded prayers. The Palau ministry is aptly called Livin' It. Unlike Billy Graham with his staid sermon-focused stadium crusades, Palau advertises his events as informal, interactive, and fun. Many of the festivals feature rock bands and skate parks. In 2003, Palau even put on a spring break festival in Fort Lauderdale, an ideal location for attracting college students who might be engaged in less than saintly behavior. The event drew more than 300,000 people. Palau is a prime example of religious leadership that transcends national borders and reaches millions. He has taken his ministry to 70 countries, broadcasts a regular radio program on more than 2,100 stations in 42 countries, and heads an organization with staff members on 4 continents. He is an unlikely success story, however. He was born in Buenos Aires, Argentina, to an affluent family of devoted churchgoers. Palau could recite Bible verses at a young age, but he didn't accept the faith as his own. According to him, he discovered God one night when he was 12, as he sat with a camp counselor in the mountains of southern Argentina in the middle of a rainstorm. 6 years later, while working full-time as a bank teller, he began preaching on the side to help support his mother and 5 sisters. By 1957, at age 23, he had launched his own ministry, complete with tent sermons and radio programs. Palau came to the United States in 1960. He met his wife, Patricia, at a seminary in Portland, Oregon, and the pair returned to Latin America as missionaries for Overseas Crusade, traveling and preaching with their 4 sons. Palau's big break came in the 1970s when he crossed paths with Billy Graham, for whom Palau worked as an interpreter and apprentice. For Palau, Graham was not only a mentor, he was a major source of funding in the formative years of Palau's ministry. Today, Palau's events carry a significant price tag. A recent festival in Washington, D.C., cost $3.5 million, paid in large part by corporate funders including Pepsi and Amtrak. John H. Dalton, the former Secretary of the Navy, was the festival chairman. In addition to his extensive global network of believers and corporate sponsors, Palau's influence now and then extends into the political sphere. He has had personal contact with President George W. Bush on a number of occasions, most recently when he accompanied Bush on an official visit to China in autumn of 2005. During the visit, the two rode to church in a limo together, chatting about the condition of Christianity in China. Palau has also been among a handful of spiritual advisors called upon by the president in the wake of national tragedies. In October 2005, President Bush invited him to speak at a memorial event for victims of Hurricane Katrina, and 10 days after 9/11, Bush included Palau in a meeting of faith leaders, a gathering held hours before he was to address Congress on the state of the nation following the attacks. According to Christianity Today, Palau, who took notes at the meeting, said Bush drew a comparison between himself and the country. Bush told the gathering, "I was a sinner in a need of redemption, and I found it." The president was referring to the difficult time earlier in life when he was a heavy drinker and lacked a sense of purpose. But the gospel became clear to him through a conversation with evangelist Billy Graham. Bush told the group that the nation was staggering and needed to get back on its feet. He said the devastation in New York challenged the nation to look deep into its heart. "I think this is part of a spiritual awakening in America," the president said. Palau has interacted with the president on less solemn occasions as well. He gave the official opening prayer at a White House reception for Hispanic Heritage Month in October 2001, an event with a star-studded cast including White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez, the pop singer Gloria Estefan, and Ray Ordonez of the New York Mets, among others. Elites and messages blended, amplified, and supported one another. Politicians gained from the association with the divine, clergy gained from the association with national power, and celebrities multiplied the power of both. It was a kind of trifecta for power cultivation in hyper-religious information age America.
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.